Welcome, everybody. We're having this special lecture by Valerie Steele, Director and Chief Curator at the Museum at the Fashion Institute of Technology, and also the founding editor of Fashion Theory, the Journal of Dress, Body, and Culture. In addition to Dr. Steele's role at FIT and her editorial role with Fashion Theory, she's also published numerous books and articles and has appeared on Good Morning America, The Oprah Winfrey Show, and The Today Show. The Washington Post has called her one of fashion's brainiest women. So I want to turn the program over to her.
Thank you so much. Fashion has been called a capricious goddess and the very paradigm of vanity, frivolity, and superficiality. Alternatively, fashion has been called the mirror of history, with the implication that it reflects wars, revolutions, and other world historical events. But fashion is neither a whirligig of meaningless change nor a blank mirror reflecting the spirit of the times. Rather, fashion is itself a part of history, providing valuable evidence of the way people thought and behaved in the past and today. By looking at fashion from different periods and different cultures, we can get a dramatic visual impression of social, cultural, and aesthetic change and variation. Moreover, fashion has its own history, and by exploring fashion's past, we can better understand its present and future. I'm starting with an image of a fashion by Alexander Hershkovitz, who is a young Brazilian designer. Now, I think it's commonly assumed that fashion is a modern Western phenomenon in marked contrast to traditional costumes of the rest of the world. And there's some truth to this. Costume does have a lot to do with custom, and fashion has a lot to do with fashioning new ways of looking. But it's not the entire picture. The glorious Ottoman robes that you see on display at the Sackler exhibit some elements of fashion. For example, patterns did change over time, and historians can date the robes. But these robes did not undergo a regular pattern of frequent style change, nor did they express to any significant degree the individual taste of the wearers, in a way that we would understand as being fashion-oriented. Within the Ottoman Empire, which was an enormous multi-ethnic empire, both custom and law prescribed certain clothes for certain people. Muslims, for example, wore different clothes than Christians or Jews. In particular, people of different religions were legally obliged to wear different kinds of shoes and hats. Only Muslims were allowed to wear turbans. The Ottomans, of course, were Turks, and thus different from Arabs, and their clothing was different as well. Clothing expressed, in other words, religious and gender identity, also ethnic and professional identity. This image from a book about Muslim cultures worldwide shows, for example, in the top row, a man of the law, then a Jewish doctor, and finally a Janissary with that amazing headgear. In the middle row, a lady and her servant in street clothing, and then in the middle, a Sufi, that is a member of a particular religious cult. And on the bottom row, first an Arab merchant, next a prostitute, and finally a woman in Syrian dress. The clothes on display at the Sackler expressed then the wearer's rank and status, their political, social, ethnic, cultural, gender, and religious identity. The clothes changed relatively little over time, and thus to a considerable extent, we can think of these clothes as existing outside of fashion. The sultan's kaftans were relatively simple in construction, and their shape did not vary dramatically over the years, from year to year, as fashionable clothing tends to do. Differences in kaftan shape, such as sleeve length, tended to express differences in status or occasion. So, for example, extra long sleeves were often worn by high-status individuals, and it was the case that persons below them were supposed to kiss the edge of the sleeve. Just as you read in the exhibition, people would kiss the hem of the sultan's robe, or Catholics would kiss the ring of the pope. Other status differences tended to be in things like fabric quality, fur lining or trimming, etc. Within the private female world, status was also expressed through dress, with certain furs, for example, being more prestigious than others. However, other elements of women's dress, such as choice and color of fabric, may have been more a matter of personal taste, because women existed primarily within the private sphere at home. Such was not the case with clothing men wore in public. Members of different military groups, such as the Janissary regiments, wore distinctive uniforms and headgear. Members of the religious hierarchy, such as mullahs, also wore distinctive dress. Here you recognize, again, some pictures of Janissaries. However, my subject today is not Ottoman dress per se. You'll be having a lot more expert speakers speaking to you on that. Rather, I want to talk to you about fashion and identity in different cultures, using the Ottomans only as one example. For example, the difference between fashion and traditional dress. Not all pre-modern, pre-Western clothes were as ruled by custom and law as Ottoman dress. Fashion is a world historical phenomenon, and it existed in many cultures across time and space. For example, in 11th century Japan, traditional or customary clothing coexisted with fashionable clothing. And here you see an illustration of a Heian court woman wearing multiple robes. This is a replica of a Heian court dress. Now, the majority of Japanese in the 11th century wore clothing that changed very little over time. But a small number of courtiers at Heian-kyo, ladies like Murasaki Shikibu, who wrote The Tale of Genji, and Sei Shonagon, who wrote The Pillow Book, were proud of wearing clothes that were imamakashi, up to date. Color combinations, for example, and you can see how you can see different colors on the sleeve varied rapidly from season to season. And someone as snobbish and sure of her own taste as Sei Shonagon would have been very dismissive of other court ladies who wore last season's colors. So this is very much fashion-oriented behavior. Even if we can't read the distinction, that's not important. They could read it very, very clearly. Now, similarly, in China there existed both fashionable and non-fashionable dress. It's sometimes said by Western historians that Chinese dress remained the same for millennia. That's complete nonsense. Any art historian can tell you, you can date Chinese art very clearly by their style of clothing. So it did change over time. But the changes that the historian or the art historian can see, that doesn't necessarily mean it's fashion in the sense that within one individual's lifetime, you can perceive regular and rapid changes. And probably we should reserve the idea of fashion for something that occurs within your lifetime so that you're aware that you're wearing clothes which are different than, you know, your older siblings or your parents. Now, even so, back in, say, 15th century Ming China, Confucian scholars complained bitterly that young people were obsessed with fashionable clothing. And they pointed out that new styles tended to derive from the town of Suzhou, which was a silk weaving town, and then they spread to other parts of China, and that men as well as or even more than young women were obsessed with these new styles. So on the one hand, you can imagine these young 15th century Chinese dressing up in the latest fashions, but then you can imagine as well men at court or men with official positions who were wearing dragon robes, which were ceremonial robes governed by custom and law, and these changed relatively little over time. Although we can date this and we can say this is a Qing dynasty dragon robe, it's not a Ming dynasty one because of various changes that occurred slowly over time. At certain points in Chinese history, there was a lot more fashion-oriented behavior. And this is an example from the Tang dynasty. during the Tang was a very outgoing period, and the country was expanding, and there was a lot of new styles coming into play. These are some Tang Dynasty court costumes, very, very flamboyant, body revealing with a low décolletage, interesting sleeves, etc. And Tang ladies also adopted some foreign styles. For example, Tang ladies who did not have bound feet yet would play polo, and for polo they would wear what was essentially Central Asian men's clothing. You can imagine how moralists hated that. Not only were they dressing as barbarians, they were cross-dressing. But this was part of a very vibrant culture that was, on the whole, quite accepting of new styles. That's different than foot binding, which came in at the end of the Tang Dynasty and lasted 1,000 years. You can't describe foot binding as a fashion. That was a really deep-seated cultural phenomenon, and its meaning, though, changed over time. If you want to know more about foot binding, you should read the new book by Dorothy Koh, K-O, who's the world's greatest expert on foot binding. In the West as well, you see both fashion-oriented and customary dress and styles of adornment coexisting. For example, in ancient Rome, the clothing styles did not change tremendously fast, but things like hairstyles changed quite rapidly in a way we would define as fashion-oriented. It's really, though, in the Middle Ages in Europe that you start to see this pattern of regular, fairly rapid style change. After many centuries of people wearing essentially T-shaped long garments, not that dissimilar from a caftan or a kimono, you start to find people wearing clothes. In addition to those long robes, they start wearing clothes which are fitted to the body, start emphasizing female curves, exposing male legs. There's a lot more emphasis on fashion choice of colors. You know, so to wear black in this context is to be making a particular fashion statement. Nevertheless, it's still, in certain of these areas in Europe, it's at courts. It's like the court of Burgundy. There's only so far you can go within a court for fashion competition and imitation. It's still not that different from the 11th century court of Heian-kyo in Japan. Still only a small number of people imitating each other and, in a way, spurring each other on to new fashion competition. It's really in the cities of the late medieval and Renaissance Europe that you start getting a wider fashion arena. And more people within, say, the Italian city-states were beginning to follow fashion and no longer paying attention to the kind of sumptuary laws which, although they were still on the books, were increasingly disregarded. So what you find is, with the decline of feudal society and the rise of capitalism and urbanism in Europe, more and more people gain greater freedom to follow new fashions. So that, for example, as Shakespeare famously said, fashion wears out more apparel than the man. In other words, obviously, the clothing can continue to exist, but young people don't want to wear it anymore. They're wearing new styles, and you get an inflationary effect so that if one individual brings in a new innovation, others will copy it and will carry it further and further and further. By the 17th century, Paris had established itself as the capital of fashion for Western Europe. And in part, this was a result of France being the most powerful state in Western Europe. And in part, it was the result of deliberate attempts by the French government to make luxury goods and fashion goods central. As Louis XIV's minister Colbert said, "Fashion will be for France what the gold mines of Peru are for Spain." In other words, a source of potentially enormous wealth. And there developed a whole culture of, on the one hand, specialized artisans creating new fashions, tailors, dressmakers, milliners, and also, equally important, a knowledgeable audience of fashion performers and observers, people who were dressing in fashionable ways and looking at what others are wearing. So on the one hand, when foreigners came to Paris, they were amazed at how obsessed with fashion Parisians were. On the other hand, increasingly, people all over the Western world were wearing French fashion. They might have their own traditional Polish or something else, but that was increasingly relegated to a kind of folk dress or specialized ceremonial occasions. As early as the 18th century, when this picture is shown, little fashion dolls were produced in the Rue Saint-Honoré in Paris and were sent as far abroad as Russia or to the American colonies so that everybody would have a chance to see what the latest styles were. Now, there still existed certain kinds of customary dress which followed the older rules. And you see Louis XIV, this is not some fashion trend that he's wearing. He's making a clear kind of political ceremonial statement in the same way that the sultans were. Similarly, in this picture of Louis XIV surrounded by members of the Academy of Sciences, it's pretty easy to pick out who's Louis XIV. And he attempted to control, to the extent that he could, what people were wearing around him. And he was very down on ladies at court who would wear new styles of dress, and he kept insisting, no, you have to wear formal, appropriate court dress. But as he got older, he began to pay less attention to this. And increasingly, fashion was not something set at court, but was something set in the city of Paris. So by the time you get someone like Marie Antoinette, her poor mother, the Austro-Hungarian empress, when Marie Antoinette sent her mom a picture of herself, her mother wrote back and said, "Who is this? This is not a queen of France. This is an actress," because she was wearing French high fashion. And in fact, she was no more of a trendsetter being queen than any other actress or fashionable urban person would have been. By the 19th century, of course, French fashion images and fashion magazines were going around the world. Magazines like La Mode Illustrée were translated into 15 different languages and were sent around the world. Nor were they just sent to Europeans and to the descendants of Europeans in newly colonized areas. The Meiji Emperor insisted that, as part of the process of modernization, members of the Japanese elite, both male and female, would wear Western dress. So what that meant is they were importing for ladies Parisian fashions, and then gentlemen were wearing either London-style suits, because London had emerged as essentially the capital of men's fashion, or uniforms. And the Japanese were very efficient. They really went around the world canvassing, like, who's got the best army? The Prussians. Okay, then we're going to bring in Prussian army uniforms. And in the same way, they were really trying to figure out what were the important aspects of becoming strong and modern. They started saying, well, we don't really like to eat a lot of meat, but let's eat meat because Westerners do, and we'll figure out if this is something that's going to help make us strong. I was reading recently that one of the doctors at the Meiji court complained that, you know, putting Japanese women in corsets instead of in kimono was really not that healthy. And the emperor was like, you may know about health, but you don't know about politics, so stay out of this. Now, I don't want to jump around too much, but let me give you a little bit of indication of how fashions emerge in different cultures. It's not just a question of taking over Western fashions the way they did in Meiji Japan. After the fall of the Qing Dynasty in 1912, with the rise of the first Chinese Republic, that's way before the 1949 Communist Revolution, new styles were developing in China as well. Now, to some extent, this came from the fact that young reformers in China felt that old traditional Chinese clothes were feudal and backward. Plus, of course, it was complicated because the whole Qing dynasty was a foreign dynasty. It was a Manchu dynasty. It wasn't ethnic Han. It wasn't ethnic Chinese. So men started wearing more in the way of Western clothes or quasi-uniforms. And what's really interesting, though, is that women in big cities like Shanghai in the 1920s essentially invented a new style of dress, known in northern China as the Qi Pao, and in southern China as the Chang Sam. And it was based, it's not traditional Chinese women's dress. Rather, it's an incredibly sophisticated modern hybrid, a combination of Manchu women's dress, Chinese women's dress, Chinese men's dress, and Western women's dress. And it was worn with high-heel shoes, not with bound feet. And it was deliberately intended to be a sign of the modern urban Chinese woman. And if you read Chinese novels from the 1920s, you'll find like older like parents-in-law who come in from the provinces are horrified when they see what their young urban sons are marrying these women who are in really tight, sexy clothes that are showing their legs. And, you know, it was very modern. This is a style which has continued to inspire Chinese designers. After the death of Chairman Mao, you begin to see the reemergence of feudal cheap house as an inspiration for Chinese designers both in the PRC and abroad. And, of course, the cheap house has also been a tremendous inspiration for a lot of Western designers. In this case, John Galliano for Christian Dior did a whole collection in 1997, the year that Hong Kong went back to the PRC, which was inspired by cheap house. Now, obviously, for John Galliano, this look meant something completely different than it did to the young women in the 1920s and 30s in China who developed the style. For him, it was exotic, it was historic, and, of course, it was also sexy. And those who know his work know that John was really inspired by 1930s bias-cut Western evening gowns. And so this was a natural style for him to gravitate toward, this kind of very body-conscious look. Incidentally, this did not sell well in the Chinese world in 97. All of the tie ties, the wealthy ladies in Hong Kong and so on, were not particularly amused by this. But subsequently, young Chinese designers started getting more interested in it again. Now I'm going to stop and show you some changes in Western fashion over the last 50 years that will give you a sense of some of the different factors at play as Western fashion, which is now really global fashion, changes over time and expresses other aspects of people's identity, and how at different times, different aspects of personal identity are prioritized, and at other times, something else will come in. So, for example, shoot your mind back to 1947. Paris has been liberated from the Nazis. It had been occupied by the Nazis from 1939 to 1945. So during that period, the capital of Western fashion was completely closed off from anything but the fascist countries. So the Americans and British had to try and design their own clothes without knowing what was going on in Paris. And this was really traumatic for them. And so Vogue, of course, was thrilled when they were able to announce that the Paris collections were coming back again. And Christian Dior started a new couture house, so there was a lot of buzz going on. What's this new couturier going to do? Dior himself said afterwards, we were emerging from a period of war, of uniforms, of women soldiers built like boxers. I drew women flowers, soft shoulders, flowing busts, fine waists, and wide skirts. It was, in fact, a dramatically different silhouette. Instead of those boxy shoulders and short skirts, it was very fluid, an hourglass figure, and voluptuous, luxurious long skirts. It was controversial. Some people said, oh, you know, it's wasting all of this fabric, it's old-fashioned, it's putting women back in this sort of Belle Epoque style. But for a tremendous number of women around the world, it was lushly feminine and romantic. And it was tremendously popular. It was knocked off. This is an American copy. There were fashion shows in Paris, and Dior went over, in Tokyo. Dior went to Tokyo. People made their own versions of it, you know, would cut up multiple dresses and make one new look dress. So from being very shocking, it became one of the first worldwide mass fashions. And it sort of set the tone for the next couple of decades, the idea that you really were looking again at Paris and you were looking to see what the next style would be. But fashion designers are not the only ones who propose new styles. There's still plenty of room left for custom and tradition and societal pressures to push you towards one style or another. Men's clothing has, for the last 200 years, been changing more slowly than women's clothing. It's been more like a kind of business uniform, more influenced by sportswear, etc. So in the 1950s, the era of, you know, political conservatism and conformity and Cold War, you get this kind of advertisement in magazines, which really sort of has this menacing 50s paranoid tone that you're being watched. Dress right. You can't afford not to. This is the same atmosphere where an American fashion designer like Ann Fogarty would write a book called Wife Dressing, which was about how you should wear the right clothes to help your husband get ahead in his job, and how you should wear a girdle morning, noon, and night so your children wouldn't grow up thinking that you were kind of some kind of slob who wandered around the house in blue jeans, that you upheld your correct gender stereotypes at home and outside. So there's still plenty of pressure what to wear, and you have to wear things which are appropriate for the right occasions and for who you are. So black cocktail dresses were very fashionable in the 50s, but young high school ladies were not, on the whole, supposed to be wearing them. At the same time, though, you see, even in the middle of the conformist 50s, new kinds of subcultural styles emerging, so that a vernacular garment like blue jeans moves off of cowboys and away from farmers and starts to be worn by young people, by rebels. It's associated with working class, so it appeals to leftists. It's seen as being very body conscious, as are T-shirts, so it starts to already become a kind of gay male icon. And it's seen, beginning to be seen as a youthful style, so even, you know, college girls and high school girls start wearing blue jeans for informal occasions. Similarly, the black leather jacket, which comes out of all kinds of motorcycle gear and aviator's gear, starts to become seen as a rebellious counter-fashion style. Then in the 60s, the era of baby boom and the emergence of the birth control pill, you have the rise of an international youth culture, but one which is focused initially in the USA and in London, Great Britain. The French are a lot slower to pick up on youth culture. If you imagine London, it's the Beatles, it's the Rolling Stones. Fashion is part of a whole culture. Americans have Elvis Presley and so on. Well, the French have, you know, what, François Hardy. It's not the same. You don't really have that rock and roll look. But you do in London, and you do in the States, and you get new styles which increasingly kids are creating for themselves. So even someone like Mary Quant, who becomes known as the inventor of the miniskirt, she says, I didn't invent the miniskirt. The girls in the street invented the miniskirt. And she said she was just one of them. We wanted clothes that were different than clothes our parents wore. We wanted something young-looking. And so these clothes developed and spread as part of a more general youth culture. They spread around the world. In some places, they were very controversial. The Catholic Church said, you know, you can't go to church wearing miniskirts. When they spread to sub-Saharan African countries, often women were attacked for wearing it, said this is not the correct kind of clothing to wear. So it was a very scandalous world fashion. The next stage in a sort of rebellious look came with the whole hippie movement, which you could think of as being a kind of hippie anti-fashion revolution. Even in the earlier in the 60s, the miniskirt was, it might have started as a youth fashion, but it was quickly co-opted by the fashion industry. So designers like Courrèges and Cardin, Saint Laurent start making mini dresses, and fashion magazines like Vogue and Harper's Bazaar put out articles like How to Frug That Fat Away, which are intended for older women, and they have lists of words that young people know, like cool, and they'll say bread equals money, chick equals a girl. They're trying to tell you how you can follow these youth fashions. The hippie things are even more radically against the whole fashion system. They say, no, no, no conformity. Who are you to tell us what to wear? We'll wear blue jeans, the whole greening of America, male, female, and blue jeans. It's going to be anti-elitist. And at the same time, people are investigating clothing of long ago and far away. going in thrift stores, traveling to Morocco and India, and coming back with all kinds of other ethnic and period clothes, which they put together in new ways. In addition, all kinds of music groups continue to have an important impact, so that just as you had had the initial sort of rock and roll influence, and earlier than that, the influence of jazz on things like the Zoot Suit, you increasingly have more and more influence of music styles and of specific styles which are coming up from different ethnic groups and subcultural groups in the U.S. in particular and also in Great Britain. The fashion industry struggles a lot in the 70s in particular to catch up with this new kind of movement. On the one hand, you have what you might say the spread of world fashion, so that blue jeans, T-shirts, parkas, generic clothes of all kind are pretty much picked up all over the world. At the same time, the high fashion industry is looking increasingly to the street, to what young people are creating. And if young people go to the Middle East and they come back with caftans, then you can be sure that European couturiers will pick up on that. They'll show it, and it'll be brought up from the street, and then it will trickle down to mass fashion, and sort of mass market manufacturers will say, well, Valentino did caftans, so let's try and knock off caftans. So it's a complicated process. Work is also increasingly an important impact on fashion. Only now, from the 70s on, it's not just influencing the male business suit, but for men and women alike, there's a sense that you want to have to dress appropriately to get ahead. It's not back to the man in the gray flannel suit, though, because it's a new look which is supposed to make both men and women look both sexy and successful. In a way, it kind of bridges the gap between the 60s, I want to wear whatever I want to wear, and the 80s, you know, greed is good, success is everything. So you have the rise of designers like Armani and the rise of Milan as a fashion center. So instead of doing fantasy fashion like Paris or youthquake fashion like London, you have Milan making real clothes for real people, albeit rich people. But the styles are things which can be worn to work and will make you look very successful. At the same time, because women have entered into higher echelons in the workforce, you're having this sort of female successful executive look. So while Armani's being shown on men, like in the movie American Gigolo, where the guy is constantly wearing Armani suits to prove how sexy he is, you also have women wearing this kind of new Armani-esque suit to prove how successful they are. In a way, that whole kind of breakdown or bending of all of the old gender rules applies to Calvin Klein's success, too, with both blue jeans and underwear, indicating young men's greater willingness to be perceived as sex objects. If you think how radical it was when they had those first images by Bruce Weber of the godlike men towering over the landscape on huge billboards wearing just their underpants, that was quite remarkable because you'd had women's images of sexy women in lingerie for years. And you began that with Joe Namath coming in, but those were so anodyne. When Calvin Klein was doing it, it was really va-va-va-voom sexy images of men. And in this way, you can perceive not only the rise of the sexual revolution from the 60s on and the rise of the women's movement, but also the rise of gay liberation and the spread of a much more sexualized image of the male body. You have also more and more influence of sportswear, to the point where 99% of the fashion that's produced today in one way or another is a variant of sportswear. It may not be active sportswear. The only sport you may engage in is running to the refrigerator. Nevertheless, everybody wants to look like they're sporty. And so increasingly, you see clothes coming out of the active sportswear vocabulary and then produced for a mass market. Similarly, you see how sportswear influences performance style and feeds into particular music styles. So again and again, we have to think of fashion. It's not only a question of clothing. anything can be fashion. Music fashions change. Furniture, car fashions change. Dance fashions change. And they're all tied in together. Increasingly, what you're seeing then is, in dramatic distinction from the Ottomans, where it said, this is my religion, this is my position in the political hierarchy, this is my profession. Instead, you're seeing clothes which are saying, this is what I, as an individual, am interested in. I'm really into hip-hop. I'm really athletic. I'm young. And these styles then spread cross-culturally. Here you see Chanel, Karl Lagerfeld for Chanel Couture, doing a kind of a knockoff of hip-hop style and complete with incredibly expensive Chanel sneakers. At the moment, sort of globalism and multiculturalism are huge influences in fashion. And the empire of fashion, I would say, has broken up now. Paris no longer rules. Instead, there are a host of style tribes which coexist. This, for example, is a look which is obviously derived from African diaspora and West African styles, but it was shown in Paris, and it was actually created by Rifat Özbek, who was a few years ago a very successful Turkish-born designer who'd studied in London. The one really important sort of dramatic change that entered into fashion in the 1980s was the rise of Japanese avant-garde fashion. And designers like Issey Miyake, Rei Kawakubo of Comme des Garçons, and Yohji Yamamoto created a real fashion revolution when they started showing in Paris clothes which were sized and fit dramatically different than other contemporary clothes then being shown in Europe and America. So when Rei Kawakubo started showing these asymmetrical, often oversized clothes in what she called 12 shades of black, I mean, it was black, black, and more black, at first the Western press completely flipped out. They said, oh, these are Hiroshima clothes. They're incredibly depressing. They're unsexy. But they caught on more and more, first with avant-garde circles, artists, filmmakers, etc. And then, of course, they launched the continuing saga of the great success of black as being sort of the urban New York kind of left bank color. It was very important, though, that the Japanese had to show in Paris before this style took off. Rei and Yohji had been showing in Japan. They had created a little nucleus of fashion followers. In Japan, Rei's followers were known as the Crows because they were all in black. But it was only when they began to show in Paris that it had an international impact. Today, the world of fashion has many, many, many fashion weeks. You can see they're really all over the world. They're in India, they're in South Africa, they're in Brazil. And there are many different designers who are trying to create within these different national and regional style centers. So, for example, there are fashion shows, big fashion shows that are held in New Delhi in India. There are big fashion shows which are held in South Africa. Their fashion shows held in Brazil. The problem is that buyers and journalists are not going around to all of these shows. So although that helps build interest in particular designers within a region, to break through internationally, it remains true that you really have to go either to Paris or to New York. A few go to Milan in order to get international exposure. And the fashion industry is a very, very tough industry. I'm going to show you a few images from one of the most interesting and creative avant-garde designers working today, who comes from a Turkish Cypriot family. Hüseyin Çalayan studied at the St. Martin's School in London, which is a very avant-garde fashion school. And then he's been showing primarily in Paris. For many people, he's too conceptual, but he's greatly admired by avant-garde fashion circles. Here you can see some images from one of his most famous shows, which is based on the concept of refugees. The idea that refugees have to take what they have and bring it with them when they flee to another country. So the top you see, he's showing the furniture being dismantled and put on. And ultimately, even the coffee table is then pulled on into a dress. Similarly, another of his collections was inspired by his Turkish background. So I saw this particular collection in Paris. The first model came out, was like an hour late, but that's, we won't go there. That's just the fashion show thing. Came out an hour late, and she's wearing sort of what looks like Turkish regional dress. And then more and more people came out, and increasingly Hussein sort of deconstructed that look and brought it towards the kind of very modern styles that for which he's known. So he is trying to bring in elements of concepts, ideas like what does it mean to be influenced by your ethnic background? What does it mean to be a refugee? He did another collection talking about what does it mean to be Islamic. So if you go back to the Sackler show for a minute and you think of how, in a sense, this kind of traditional clothing went as far as it could in the direction of a fairly static identity politics. It's really, really magnificent, but it's not responsive to the kind of individual self-expression which has become so much a part of modern identity. The textiles, for example, are incredibly beautiful and could be used as inspiration for contemporary fashion, but there has to be a huge quantum leap that has to fit into a whole other world of music, of sports, of everything else which is shared internationally. Fashion designers today try and take opportunities in this much more open fashion system to explore what interests them personally and hope that it will appeal to their audience. Now, some of them, in a sense, are like magpies who take elements from different periods and different cultures and appropriate them for their own style. This was from quite a fantastic Dior Couture collection designed by John Galliano, and the dresses were very much inspired by sort of period 1900 European high fashion. And then the beaded corsets and the beaded neck corsets were inspired, well, Galliano said they were inspired by the Maasai, but in fact, what he really meant was they were inspired by the Dinka of South Africa, because Dinka men traditionally wore a kind of beaded corset. Then you have another designer like Shuli Bet, of Mali born, who was born in Mali and who showed in Paris, who did another version very much from the inside, from being an African himself, and trying to put together clothes which were recycled from older clothes, because that's another component of the global fashion system. If you give your clothes to Goodwill, they may end up, you know, in a whole other country being auctioned off at a market somewhere else on the other side of the world and being re-put together. There's been a lot of criticism on political grounds of this kind of appropriation, and certainly there's an awful lot of fantasy that goes into it. This is from Saint Laurent's 1977-78 Chinese collection, which is sort of loosely inspired by Chinese imperial dress. But when you hear quotations from Saint Laurent talking about, you know, sort of Mongol princesses and so on, it's clear that he has this really total fantasy image of ancient Cathay, which has little or nothing to do with China as it ever was, but that's inspiring him. Other designers have been very much inspired by the kind of utilitarian workwear, Mao-style suits, and I'm using Chinese examples because I did a lot of research on that a few years ago. This was very popular as a look as well, but it also expresses a particular kind of fantasy. I mean, as soon as Mao died, everybody in China was out of those Mao suits as fast as they could possibly get rid of them. They really did not want to have their personal identity totally submerged into the blue uniform. Here we have another John Galliano. You can see this is just really a pastiche of different styles to the point where you can't even tell where anything came from. It's sort of like a blender. Take Chinese, Japanese, African, Mongolian, throw it in a blender, and it comes out. And people who see this type of image go, I never see anything like that. This is a complete fantasy. This stuff sells like hotcakes, but it sells in pieces. So what you're finding is people are wearing the jacket from, they're not wearing the full outfit, but pieces of it. You have to realize that a fashion show as it exists now, particularly in Paris, is like kind of like an advertisement for a particular source of inspiration. And then when it actually reaches the store, not everything on the runway will be in the store for a start. They won't have the headdress, for example, but they'll have the pieces, which will all be separated, and then you will buy them piece by piece rather than as a whole thing. And finally, the last image. This is a Chinese-American designer, Vivian Tam, who did a very, very irreverent design with images of Mao Zedong with his hair like a little girl and, you know, wearing dark glasses and so on, all of which would never, ever have been sanctioned by China's Red Emperor, and which indicates, I think, very clearly how incredibly different fashion is today from the way it was under a traditional regime. Thank you very much. I know that Walter Denny is going to be giving his talk at 3:30, but I'd be willing to take a couple of questions before I close down. Yes?
When you mentioned the qi pao, where did that originate for? There weren't designers, were it just garment makers? Who came up with that?
It's a great question. Who came up with the qi pao if there weren't really sort of fashion designers? Well, you had dressmakers, and you had the individual women themselves. So just as in Europe before the sort of real professionalization of a fashion industry, you had people taking, there was a long robe which Manchu women wore and long robes which Chinese men wore, and individuals started, whether themselves or in conjunction with their dressmakers, fiddling with that and coming up with, someone would get it more, that would be narrower than someone else, and then someone else would say, let me try and do it with the sleeve shorter. And so it really was just in the same way, really, that girls in the 60s in London came up with the mini dress. One would wear it a little shorter. Another would wear it a little bit shorter. It was like a conversation between individuals. And this, in fact, is really important because it plays on the individual's identity, and not in the sense of so much a political identity, although there is the sense of an urban Chinese modern woman's identity, but very much a question of individual taste. And there's a really brilliant book you should look at called A Matter of Taste by a Harvard sociologist, and he talks about how names, such as what do you name your child, are very much a matter of taste, and how this changes in ways which are like fashion. So there are a number of influences that come into play that you might think is the most personal thing in the world. I have chosen to name my child Stephen or Rebecca. But then you find that, like that New Yorker cartoon, remember a few years ago, all the mothers are leaning out the back door of the house going, Christopher, Christopher, Christopher. How come their old names come into fashion? And in the same way that certain styles of dress do. And the author of that comes up with some really, really interesting information. Some of it symbolic, but an awful lot of it just aesthetic, like the way certain names sound or the way certain colors or certain styles look, which resonate with people at a particular time. And it always is building on what went before. So nobody invents new fashions wholly out of the cloth that looks completely like nothing ever seen before. Fashions to succeed have to draw on fashions from the past but catch something else that appeals to other people at the time. Yes?
Where did the splashing the designer's name all over the clothing start? Who is responsible? How do we stop it?
Well, stopping it is easy. That's entirely up to consumers. It's but it really came in a big, big way in the 70s. Designer, the idea of the grief, the label, the signature of the couturier, that came in the 19th century. But it wasn't, and then you start to see some of the symbols like the double G's for Gucci coming in the 60s, and then the double C's for Chanel. So you get these logos. And then, again, New Yorker cartoons are great because there was one from the early 70s that showed a woman going out of her apartment and her doorman is holding the door for her and she's wearing her scarf says Saint Laurent, her coat says Cardin, her skirt says Gucci, and he goes, "Hello, Mrs. Smith." And he goes, "That's so ludicrous," because she's identifying herself with all of these other name brands. Different periods, people think it's more or less chic or tacky to be associated with lots of obvious labels. Increasingly, there's a sort of a movement that it should be more subtle. But even so, it has to. It's like it still has to signal to certain other people what you're wearing to communicate. The Prada stuff is interesting. When Prada started to become fashionable and it started to be joked about on television, one character would say, "Why is that woman dressed like an airline stewardess from 1960? And his girlfriend would go, "That's Prada." And it would only signal to some people but not to others. Thank you so much.